out of nowhere.
We have no clue who he is. He brings no resume. We barely know anything about his parents. We know just the basic genealogy. And the point of Avram is that it's the story of every man. Hashem intentionally does not want to display all of his past feats and heroics, because then we would exclude ourselves. Well, I'm not Avram. I don't carry his resume. Why should I be selected? Why should I feel mission? Why should I change my life? If I were Avram, that'd be a different story. So there is an Avram message, but the problem with the Avram message is, well, what does it take to be an Avram, and how can I generate the Avram traits? With Moshe, we have a lot of background. We have a lot of background before the snap. Before Hashem has his moment of Lech Lecha with Avram, that's essentially Avram, Moshe's Lech Lecha, when Hashem calls him to mission, a lot of stories of Moshe. And many of these stories about Moshe himself. So, for example, he's very compassionate. He's very sensitive. He could easily sequester himself and insulate himself from other people's suffering, but he doesn't. And he specifically remembers. It's not like he happens to see someone suffering and he feels an emotional rush. He specifically leaves the palace to see how people are faring. So he makes a choice. Sometimes compassion is a choice, and maybe we'll talk about this a little bit later. It's a choice you make, whether you want to expose yourself to suffering, and I don't just mean expose yourself visually, but expose your heart, or you want to flee from it emotionally. Do you want to engage in it? Do you want to disengage in it? And he takes his life into his own hands. He imperils his future. He imperils his career. At this point, he becomes a fugitive. At this point, he has to flee in Mitzrayim. And it's one of the psukim in the Torah that I'd really like for you to try to live your life by. Sometimes people complain, and I have so little tolerance for people that complain about things that aren't willing to do anything to solve them, and to take struggle on, and to live the life that will try to solve it. Rabbi Lam, Zichrono Livracha, used to be the president of Shu University. He was a rabbinic figure, wasn't just a president, like a mankal. He was a leading figure in the community. He was once at a meeting with a lot of the board members who were complaining that there weren't enough young men in those days, young men who were entering rabbinics and were entering education. And what can YU, what can Yeshiva University do about it, and how can we solve it? At which point, evidently, he stopped the meeting and he said, I just have a question for you. How many people in this room would be happy if their child became a rabbi or a teacher? And no one raised their hand. Now, he was probably too genteel to say it, but I would have said, so shut your mouth. If you care deeply about something, and you only care enough to complain about it, but you don't really care enough to do something about it, then maybe you just don't really care about it enough. Because you want the comforts, that's parasitical, basically. You need work to be done. You need benefits for our community, but you're not willing to pay any price. You're not willing to suffer any life of struggle. You're not willing to have your child. So it's so selfish, it's so egotistical. So try to lead your life by that mantra. Try to always, if you find yourself complaining about something, it could be large issues like that, it could be smaller issues, and you're not willing to try to solve it, then who are you? What type of person are you? Let's just be quiet. At least have decency and the self-respect not to voice your complaints. Okay, people may not have the same stamina. People may not have the same courage to take on responsibility. I accept that. People have different levels. People have different capacities. But then just don't complain about something. If you're not willing to be part of the solution, then don't complain. And it's easy to complain. Easy to be an armchair complainer. So Moshe sees suffering. There's no one. Again, it's a metaphor. Even Kovachov, the Archaeanish, in this case, there's no one helping the Jew. So this is an extreme case. This is a radical case. But just think about life. Think about all the issues you encounter. It doesn't mean you're going to solve it, but at least you want to be part of the solution. Rather than letting people clean the world up for you so that you can enjoy it and you could have your padded existence. It just feels so morally offensive. And Moshe takes great, great peril. The next day comes out, and it's not so much in peril, but just you see what happens in life is when people are victimized and they're abused and they suffer other people's anger and torment and torture, you know what the easiest way to solve it is? To just victimize someone else, to pass it on to someone else. That's what he sees. Basically, who are these two Jews? We know them to be Dasan and Aviram. But they've been suffering their whole lives as slaves. So they're just taking it out on each other. They're fighting with one another. And he just realizes how petty this behavior is. You see in life, you'll see people in life, and see how easy it is. And when you meet with frustration, and people scream at you, and you feel tension, the easiest thing is to come back at home and let your husband have it, or let your kids have it. Take it out on your kids. Take it out on someone weaker. Go to work and take it out on the younger person at work. Take it out on the friend that's less cool than you, less confident. Stop yourself. Don't be part of that cycle of victimization, that cycle of abuse, and that cycle of, it's so easy that you're always on a food chain, and there are always people that are less authoritative than you, and you can easily get away with taking it out on them, a student, or a child, or a friend, or someone at work that you're their superior. It's just, I promise you, that person is taking it out on the person beneath us. At some point, someone's got to make the decision to cut the cycle. Someone's got to make the decision. If I'm not strong enough, if I'm not valiant enough, I'm not morally courageous enough just to let it end here, to let that person scream at me or say something mean to me or curse me out or something, then it's just gonna continue to build and cycle through one another and fight people down the line. So what she's telling these people, I understand you're slaves, I understand you're frustrated, I understand you've lived lives of torment and suffering. They're picking out each other. That's exactly his plan, exactly Power's plan, is to create social corrosion. The only way you can defeat tyranny is by social cohesion. And then we can defeat issues in life by collaboration. And you're tearing apart any collaborative spirit by fighting with each other. But of course, this isn't the best choice for Moshe, because he should keep a low profile. He's on the lam. He's a fugitive. He don't want to start intervening in other people's affairs. He wants to keep it quiet. It's not my business. And at this point, he realizes he has to run to Midian. And he runs to Midian. And the first thing he does, he gets to the local bar. Their local bars were Wells. And the same thing. You don't pick a bar fight when you're a fugitive. You want to slink off into the side and get a hotel room and watch cable television or something. Order some pizza. You know, not that I've ever been a fugitive, okay? Never been a woman, never been a fugitive, never planned either, okay? Hope neither comes true. But you want to slink off to the side and hide in a small hotel and go shopping early in the morning when no one can see you, late at night. Again, I've never been a fugitive. If I were, that's how I would be if I were a fugitive. I would not go to the bar and stop picking fights with local bullies who are beating on some girls. Okay, beat him up. It's not my issue. It's just going to get me into more trouble. Police are going to see bolos. Bolos, and when the picture comes through on the facts, they're going to see who you are. And Moshe has irrepressible moral indignance. And at some point, people's moral indignance runs so deep that they're almost uncontainable. I knew someone like that. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, who was Rabbi Soloveitchik's brother. He was amazing to watch. He just couldn't control himself. He got himself in trouble. He decided in Chicago, and Chicago is a big city, and big cities have a lot of kosher needs. And for years and years in America, it's a fascinating history, kosher meat was controlled by the mafia. Jews and the mafia were in control of kosher meat. And that means the meat prices were held very, very high. So a different point, and not only that, but you can only be a shochet if you paid off the right person, whatever you can imagine. So the various rabbanim who tried very hard to deregulate shlita. It didn't work out that well for them. He's actually very, 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 very big Rosh Hashiva from Europe already. His name is Reuven Grozovsky, who's a Talmud of Baruch Ber Leibowitz. There's a Talmud of the Briska Rav, who's a Talmud of Chaim, like a really significant Rosh Hashiva. He's very involved in trying to dismantle the Shlita Mafia. Not, he wasn't facing the Mafia, he was trying to build Shlita, but everyone in the Mafia was in the background. And in 1952, he was involved, look at me, in a car accident. He had a stroke, and he was very significantly maimed, and a couple of years later, he died. And you're not going to read about this in the newspapers because the police never investigated it in the 50s, but people in the know believe that this was one of the great Rosh Hashivas of the day. It would have been like a Rosh Hashiva. They would have heard of him. He died at a young age. He got into a car accident. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik tried to battle the mafia in Chicago. Okay, goodbye, Rabbi Soloveitchik. He left Chicago. He got kicked out of Chicago. Because he just had this irrepressible moral spirit. I remember I went to his shir in 1987. He'd come into shir where we're learning sirus, like we're learning now. And he would start reading the Gemara in his very heavy Lithuanian accent. And he would read every line. And when he would teach, he would read every word of the Gemara, every word of Rashi, every word of Tosfos. It was like his style. Just read and then any ideas to say, but he would read every word on the page. And I still remember, he sat down, the room was full of 100 people. The New York Times came, it was the first day, Rabbi Soloveitchik's younger brother was coming, Rabbi Soloveitchik had already retired. He started saying, this is the first Mishnah in Zechskivus, Betulah Nisei Le'ayim Harvi.
Those women who are ruining Judaism.
He went off on a harangue against feminism. And then the next day,
Shachtil Chachamim, Al Takanas B'Nois Yisrael,
Ronald Reagan is divorcing. Then he went for 2 hours against Ronald Reagan. And then, like, he couldn't hold himself back. Every time he got to some issue that he felt was a moral injustice, he would just explode. He just couldn't, with Lord Gemara, he just couldn't hold it. I remember Rav Lichtenstein, Rav Aaron, once told us that we should have moral role models in our life. Whenever you face a moral issue, don't ask yourself in theory what's right and wrong, because you all know in theory what's right and wrong, and we all know that we fail to live up to our theories, because in the heat of the moment, we lose our cool, we lose our strength. You should always have someone that you know whose moral experience you respect, and put yourself in their shoes and say, how would they behave? Trust me, it really works. When I was younger, I mean, I'm still struggling with moral issues, but when I was younger and the issues that you struggle with when you're young, I always ask myself, and wasn't, you know, how would that person behave when they're angry? How would that person behave when they're jealous? How would that person behave when they're petty? It was much more helpful to me than asking how to beat jealousy, how to beat anger, how to beat pity. Things that I worked on in my life. So we asked Rav Aaron, we said, well, who is your moral role model? And we all expect him to say the obvious answer, the Rav, right? 9 people out of 10 are no Rav Aaron. He said, no, it's Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, his brother. And the second Rav Aaron said it, having met Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, yeah, it makes sense. And I think about Rav Aaron Soloveitchik every year than I read about Moshe Rabbeinu, because it's literally Rav Aaron Soloveitchik coming into a bar and seeing some Midianite women who he doesn't know he's going to marry them. It wasn't his choice. Yisro invites him. It's like he had a crush on them. He just sees women who are suffering, but that's what a Jew does. A Jew sees injustice. And the truth is, and excuse me for a sidebar, like Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, we haven't really even gotten to the point yet, but if you get a chance, if those of you pick up a Jerusalem Post, if not, I'll put it up on Facebook and Twitter. This is what I wrote about this week in the Jerusalem Post. What's happened over the last 200 years is that non-Orthodox Jews who have decentralized religion and written that religion, but ritual and halacha and commandments, so they built a religion out of social justice and tikkun olam and social crusades and defending the weak and defending, and in Israel also, the left parties who are less interested in settling greater Israel, less interested in creating a Torah space here in Eretz Israel, so they've become the parties of social justice. And Orthodox people, both in Chutz La'aretz and in Eretz Israel, have a recoil to that. They say, well, we're not secular, we're not reformed, and it's almost as if tikkun olam and social justice and social crusades and defending the weak and defending against discrimination is a non-Orthodox platform because it's so deeply associated with non-Orthodox people. And that is an overreaction. Okay, now it is an overreaction if your entire world was built on Tikkun Olam. That is an overreaction. Okay, there's a lot more to Tikkun Olam. There are a lot more worlds than this world. This is just the world we inhabit for X amount of years. And we're all going to leave this world. And you can make the claim that Tikkun Olam is worthless. And that would be a legitimate claim because you're in this world for X amount of years. You should be building eternity, not concerned with the affairs of this world. I obviously don't agree with that. And the name of Rav Lichtenstein of Lichtenstein said that even though this world is a passageway and the next world is a palace, even when you're in the passageway, for the time you spend in the passageway, renovated for the improvement of those who will follow after you. But no one, no Jewish person, no visionary Jewish person should ever invert that hierarchy between the passageway and the palace. This is a passageway. The next world is the palace. This is transient. The next world is eternal. This is a world we inhabit for a space. The next world is reality. Now, given those parameters, each person calibrates between the two. But the conversation has to begin that way. And the conversation of Tikkun Olam threatens a religion built around Tikkun Olam, doesn't just threaten to draw resources away from Torah Mitzvahs, it threatens to invert that whole. Yes, I'm involved in Tikkun Olam, the real world, not this world. I'm sitting and learning Gemara all day, I'm involved in Tikkun Olam. The real world that I'll inhabit for 500 billion years, whatever, not for ever met Shamash Ingerton. I'm just saying that intentionally to be provocative. So I understand why there's been an Orthodox recoil. I understand it totally, but it's been an overreaction. That is Moshe's tradition. That is Avram's tradition. And Moshe even more so than Avram. You don't see Avram involved in Tikkun Olam. You see Avram being a moral megaphone, describing moral values, living moral values, quelling wars, being flexible, making compromises. That's not social justice. That's moral behavior. Moshe is a fighter. Moshe crusades for the weak. Moshe defends women, vulnerable people, petty people. That's Moshe. It's a difference between being a moral voice and having a social ethos. You care about the shape of society, and in particular, those who are the most vulnerable, those who are the weakest. That is our tradition, and unfortunately, this shift. You know, we have no questions on prefaces. This is just a preface.
Terminology. Question on terminology.
Okay, terminology. Quickly.
Can you
Social justice, crusading for social justice. Okay, Moshe is that person. And the final snapshot we have of Moshe before we get to the women, final snapshot of Moshe is he's just a very loyal person. Hashem tasks him to go to Mitzrayim. What does Moshe say? I got to ask my father-in-law. What? Hashem told you to go to Mitzrayim and save lives and redeem history and bring the Jews to the promised land. You got to ask your Midianite father-in-law? The answer is yes. That's called loyalty. And it's an underrated trait. No one is in this room because you're loyal to me, I hope. Everyone's in this room because we have convergent interests. I want to teach, you want to learn, so we're here. Loyalty means when your interests are different, but you have a shared past, and people in the past have helped you, or at least shared your experiences in the past, even when your lives change. Remember that girl you're no longer friendly with because she's, I don't know, in a different place right now, she's not from Dati or whatever. And that person calls, we have a shared past, and you do something for me, and I'll do something for you, and it's loyalty, and it's a trait that's a very, very different trait. It's very hard to describe unless you've lived it. Like, ask yourself, when's the last time you acted out of loyalty? Okay? And loyalty essentially emerges where there's absolutely no overlapping interest. Where it's not like you have any purpose for doing it other than you're loyal. Like, even, like today I had a Levaya to go to. I go to a lot of Levayas for people from my community in Brooklyn where I grew up, who, you know, are now at the stage of my parents' friends who are, some of them are passing. So I go to Levaya's and Pete, but today I couldn't because I was teaching, but even that, I do it, I feel loyalty, but at the end of the day, it's a mitzvah. So I have a convergent interest. I have an interest other than doing a mitzvah of Halvaya Sameis and doing a mitzvah of Nechama Venus. I really wouldn't call that loyalty because I'm accomplishing something other than. I have an interest in being there. Obviously, that's a chesed that's unilateral. It's not like doing something for anyone else, but the person's not doing, it's not reciprocal. It's hard to call that loyalty. But when's the last time you did something out of pure, pure loyalty? There was no interest whatsoever. You had no benefit you were gaining. You just, someone from your past needed you, or someone that did you a favor asked for a favor, and there was no relationship that you were trying to invest in, and you reciprocated a favor. I saw Rav Lichtenstein act out of loyalty several times in ways that were destructive to the yeshiva, taking boys into yeshiva that didn't belong, or taking decisions for yeshiva for about loyalty to people in their past. So this is what we see in Moshe, and you have none of this in Avram. But what you also have in Moshe is not just the prequel, but the prequel to the prequel, like two movies before, not just, I guess, what I call Batman Begins, but the beginning of Batman, you know, all the way back, because you see how he was born. And you see the women who are responsible for his birth. And, ironically, but not so ironically, the real heroism is not about his biological mother. The real heroism are his two godmothers, Miriam and Batya. I want to talk a little bit about Miriam, a little bit about Batya, and you can help me determine. I'll just say the values as I see them and experiences, you can determine whether this is something that women have a particular penchant for, a particular ability for that men don't or have lesser of. So who was Miriam and what were her role? There were two snapshots of Miriam. One in a medrash and one in the actual verse. So let's see the medrash first and see the verse that it's attached with. Yelech ish mi beis levi, it's source number one aleph, v'yikachas bas levi. This is a very, very mysterious, cryptic pasuk. A man from the house of Levi marries a woman who's a daughter of Levi. And they have a son. We know who that son is. It's Moshe Rabbeinu. So the question is, why the drama? Tell us who they are. We're going to know anyway in a few seconds. There's going to be a list of who Moshe's father and mother were. Everyone in the world knows that this Ishmi Beis Levi is Amram and this Ishmi Bas Levi is Yocheved. There's no great mystery here. Why is the Torah taking an event of such great import and submerging and camouflaging the names? Why is it generic? So Rashi cites the Medrash and the Medrash fills us in. It's generic because there's a backstory. Amram comes home one day, and I'll make it into 21st century jargon, and he basically turns to his wife and he has two words for her. He looks at Yocheved and he says, I'm out. I'm done. This is futile. This is pointless. Just to stay married, just to have more children, any moving forward now is moving backwards. If we have another child, we're just preparing the next dinner for the crocodiles. At this point, there's no purpose in having another child, and there's no purpose in maintaining our family. We have two children. Or Yotze the mitzvah of Peruvu, point to Beis Hillel, man and woman, Aaron and Miriam. That's it, Splitsville. And it's not clear from the Medrash, does he divorce Yocheved? Do they just separate? But there's marital breakdown. It's not discord, it's just the pressure of power. The pressure of, there's no horizon of hope, there's no future. Right? What are you going to raise a family when every child gets murdered? So let's read the Medrash. It's a pasuk in the Gemara in Sota. Amar Rav Yehuda bar Zvina shehalach basasutana. Amram gadol ador. He's a very well-known person. Kivan sherash amar paro harash akala ben hayilot ha'ir tashichu. Upon hearing this murderous genocidal decree, Amar l'shav anu amelam. This is all pointless. Amad v'girish asishto. So he divorces Yocheved. So does everyone do? Maki see, maki do. They follow the leader. Everyone divorces their wife. At which point Miriam steps in and says, Abba. Abba. She says three words to her father. She says, I understand the world around you is nightmarish. I understand it doesn't make sense. I understand it's crushing and it's mysterious. But right now, your responsibility is not to solve the bigger calculus. You know what your responsibility is right now? Here are the three words she tells her father. Your responsibility is to hold the line. You hold the line. You do yours. You don't back down from your halachic responsibility, and even if there aren't halachic responsibility, from your moral duties. How this will unfold, I don't know. You don't know. We may never know. But all we can do is hold the line. And take the right decisions, even if we don't know where it's going to land. And she steps in. And because she steps in, Amram marries Yocheved again, or reunites with Yocheved. And because it was so influential and impactful upon society, because everyone else then reunited with their wives, so it's described as a generic. It's not just a man named Amram marrying a woman named Yocheved, but it's a man marrying a woman, a narrative or a scenario that plays out in many, many homes in many, many Jewish cities. Vayelchish, Vayikachish. We need to know the specifics, but not too much, not names. Ish, Bebeslevi, Baslevi. It's such a crucial lesson in life because you're going to find moments in which you can't make sense of life. And in most experiences in life, when you can't make sense of something, you give up. But when it comes to faith, halacha, more responsibility, you don't. Let me give you an example, okay? I used to interview students for the yeshiva. Baruch Hashem, a little less involved in that. Delicious part of my life. I used to interview boys for yeshiva. And part of what I wanted to see and to gauge is not just how firm they were, how much Gemara they learned, how well they davened. I wanted to see who they were as Jews. Are they proud Jews or not? Because Jewish identity is part of religious identity. If you're a proud Jew and a strongly prideful Jew, that's going to feed your religious depth. Because everything feeds religion. The more Jewish you feel, I think this is part of what we're missing in Chutzlar. It's not Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is a whole different. Chutzlar is the thing we're creating a lot of religious energy, but not enough Jewish identity. Who are we? Where do we come from? What's our story? What does it mean to be? Here's a good experiment for everyone, okay? I know the Israelis probably have an easier time responding to this. Close your eyes, not to close your eyes, but close your imagination and think of the person you met or read about in history who was the best Jew you knew without being religious, without being Orthodox. Who? What? Herzl, Begin. I would say Begin, Herzl. Herzl's too far. I knew Begin. I saw him. I didn't know Begin. I heard it was good. Natan Sharansky, you know, it was Dati in the class. People who are so deeply, deeply invested in their Judaism and their Jewish identity and their care for Jewish people and their care for Jewish legacy. It may not have to be someone famous, but a teacher you had, a neighbor you had. I mean, in Israel, they're all around you. In Chutzar, it's a little harder to find. So I'm sure the Israeli girls have an easier time, but that's why I asked the question. I want you to be able to disassociate Jewish identity from Jewish religion or ritual. So I would always ask the following question or an interview. If you had a DeLorean, you know what I'm talking about? Okay, Back to the Future, right? A car that can go back to the future. If you had a time machine, but for the good movie buffs, all the 80s, like 80s culture, a DeLorean, the car that you can go back in time with, and you had one setting, only one setting. The fuse is going to burn out after one trip. One setting to go back and come back to Jewish history. Which part of Jewish history would you go back to? Now, there are, like every question I ask, there are 99 right answers and one wrong answer. There's no way to get this. Like, if a boy answers, I want to go back to 1980 to watch the Super Bowl between the Giants and the Jets, you fail. You don't get it. I want to go back to see the World Series. Now, I want to go back to have the pizza that my father talked to. If you talk like that, you're out. If you say anything else, you pretty much, you got that question. Obviously, you can impress me more the way you answer the question if the answer is sophisticated and deep. But 90% of the answers are Kriyas Yamsuf, Mamar Har Sinai, Briyat HaOlam. Again, I'm not looking to, 90% of the answers. I just want to see if there's some Jewish identity in you, and you pass that question, right? Once, what's your
name?
So that's my answer.
Interesting.
That's my answer. So I'll tell you why.
Or by two. One of the two.
Right, no.
They may.
A little different, but here's my answer. Listen carefully. It's an important, I'll tell you why. In one interview, a boy asked me, where would you go, Rabbi? So first of all, I accepted him on the spot because I liked his chutzpah. Because you can only go far in life with chutzpah. You can't go far in life if you're a sheep. You have to learn how to channel that chutzpah, how to channel that energy, how to channel. It's not easy. But either you're going to be steamrolled because you submit to everything, or you're going to stand and make something of yourself and hopefully make it pious and holy and you became someone great. Not going to tell you. I have a lot of interview questions. I used to ask, if you were a tree, what type of tree would you be?
I only know one kind of tree.
Which one? Okay, so again, the reason I ask the question is I want to see, especially with boys who are a little bit emotionally, let's say, underdeveloped, I want to see if they can abstract themselves and talk about them, their emotions, their life, their personality, project it onto a tree. And again, 99% of the answers are oak tree, fig tree, olive tree, apple tree, because I give fruit to people, blah, blah, blah. Whatever, you get it right. And again, the only way to get that wrong is, well, what's a tree? Or, who am I? It's like, then I know that we're dealing with someone that maybe won't fare so well as you at Eretz Yisrael. But the best answer I ever got, and I'm not going to tell you whom, he's another big rabbi today. He said, Rabbi, if I'd be a tree, I'd want to be an Asherah tree so everyone could bow down to me. So I said, this is a guy with chutzpah. I'm going to take this bronco and break him, and I'll turn him into something great. And he's a big rabbi today, so I'm not going to tell you who these people are. But one day, maybe you'll meet them in a bar or something, or in a watering hole, and they'll tell you the story. They'll tell you the story. Anyway, what were we talking about? Right, so this person asked me, Rabbi, where would you go back? I said, if I could go back to one point of Jewish history, I'd go back to 1945. That's crazy. 45? Like, go to 48 already. 3 years away. No. I want to walk out of Auschwitz with the survivors, right, and stand right next to them. Why? Because what was the first thing they did? Those who survived. After they recovered, they got medical attention, they got a little bit to eat, a couple weeks later, bury the dead. First thing they did is, let me try to find someone from my community, my sister's friend, my niece, my cousin's cousin, from the shtetl, from the village, and let's remarry, let's rebuild. Let's bring people into this world. Let's name after the people who are murdered. Now, 2020 hindsight, we know who those kids were, who were born in 46 and 47 and 48. These were people who changed history. These were people who fought in the Independence War and liberated Yerushalayim in 67 and built our country in the first generation Dor Rishon. So I know that those decisions they took in 46, 47 were legendary. They shaped history. But they didn't have 20/20 hindsight. As far as they knew, the world was collapsing. As far as they knew, Jews had no home to go to. As far as they knew, Europe was in rubbles. As far as they knew, there were pogroms in Polish towns and Jews returned. As far as they knew, ships were being turned away from ports across the world. And how in the world can you bring children into that world? How in the world can you bring children to that nightmare? The answer is, you just hold the line. You stand tall and you defy history. And that's called moral courage. When the world around you is crumbling and you can't change it, you can't fix it, you can't repair it, but you stand tall and defiant and you do not budge from your halacha or your moral duties, and those decisions are always yours. And I would just like to stand next to those people and feel that moral energy, because I appreciate people of moral energy. I appreciate people of moral courage. Learn in life to find it. You're going to spend a lot of time the next couple years in McDillows, in Army, those who are going to Army, University. A lot of people will come through your screens. Don't be impressed by people who are smart. Smart is so totally overrated. It means nothing in this world. Nothing. It'll get you nowhere. It'll get you diplomas and maybe some money. Not the things that count. We should be impressed with traits and values, and you'll see them. It's not just from Jews, not just Dati people. You'll see a lot of people, non-Dati, people going back to America, a lot of non-Jewish, try to sense which people live their lives based on values that you can learn from. You're growing, you're developing your identity. And the people in your lives, you have to be able, again, it doesn't mean you should walk out of a classroom with a teacher you don't think is a morally upright person. Just don't be inspired by it. Don't try to become that. Remember in college, I tried to focus my eyes on the teachers and say, like, who are these people? I wanted to see which parts of their life are coming through. And in Army, and in life, and in college, over the next years. So like to now, through like the next 7-8 years of your life, you're really building identity. When you're 27, 28, you're pretty much you. You pretty much have your identity intact and it's built. So try to find those people of moral courage and moral strength. I think a lot about Miriam, and I think a lot about that question the boy asked me, you know, on the interview. And when I think about Miriam, it's exactly what Miriam says. The world around this Abba makes no sense. I understand that. I understand that any child you and Ima have is just going to be breakfast for the crocodiles tomorrow. I can't answer that question. I just know you can't back down from evil. You can't back down from a calculus you can't understand. Can't tell you how many children to have up. I can't tell you how to face it, but follow halacha and follow moral guidance and do what's right. And she changes history. And Moshe's born. And I keep telling you this, please try to absorb this. When you're young, you don't get it yet. You have to really try as hard to train yourself. It's going to take a while. Human history is not shaped by headline-grabbing events. Politics and generals and politicians and it seems that way if you freeze frame the moment, like who's everyone following and who's the son who's getting money. But politics is like the ebbs and the tides of the ocean. The tides come in, the tides go out. And policies come and policies go. And empires rise and empires fall. And victories are achieved and then victories fail. So it's just a tide. And these tides don't happen overnight. They happen over 30 and 40 and 50 years. But it's just tides. The real way you shape this world are these quiet, hushed, private, unknown decisions of courage. You take these courageous decisions to just do what's right. No one will notice. No one will herald you. You're not going to write any glaring headlines. That's how you shape the world. I'm not telling you not to be involved in politics. If you decide you want to be involved in politics or broader public agendas, that's great. But don't for a second think that's a replacement for moral courage. And that's generally not a place of moral courage. You can express moral courage. But the real decisions you take are marriage and parenting and neighboring and living. And those of you touch very deeply and you instill with deep values and you shape their lives and the lives of the people they're going to come into contact with. And that's how you make real change in this world. I can't tell you whether this is a uniquely female moment. I don't know. I would hope I'd be capable of that. I was trying to think to myself on the way here. Is there something that being a woman is able to respond that way? I'm not coming up with anything, but maybe you can think like that. Do women have that ability that men cannot? Like, why didn't Amram get it and Miriam got it? Was it because he was a man and she was a woman? Or what about Yocheved? Was it because he was a leader and she wasn't? Was it because he was older and she was a newer generation? And it doesn't stop there. Because 3 months later, the Medrash tells us, they can no longer hide Moshe. So they have to cast him into the Nile. So take a look at source number Dalet. This is a Medrash. Lo yachla od hasfino. They can no longer hide Moshe. Nazaf ba'aviha. This is an amazing Medrash. Source number, and source number Dalet, part one Dalet, first page. Nazaf ba'aviha. Amram starts mocking Miriam. You're the one who told me to marry Ima and to have another child. Look at what's happening. He starts ridiculing his daughter. Now again, it's hard for Amram, and take it into context. I'm not blaming Amram. But sometimes when you make hard decisions, you have to be willing to take verbal insults and to withstand, to defy people who mock your decisions. It's almost true that every brave decision you'll make in life will meet with mockery. It's almost true, because if it weren't brave, if it weren't unusual, it wouldn't be brave. It's brave because it's unusual. It's unusual and people will mock it. It's almost always true. You do something great, people won't get it. They don't get it. The first response is to mock it. When I made Aliyah in 1993, before Nefesh B'Nefesh, when no one came here, and I had a great career planned in America, people mocked me. People came to my parents in shul, they said, don't worry, you still have two other children, as if I was involved in a car accident. Because I was falling off the face of the earth. But I did what I thought was right. And you look back at the decisions. I'm not going to share all my decisions, but I look back at the major decisions I made. Not, again, I'm poor right now, no one's going to mock me. I'm a little bit older, but when I was growing up, the decisions I was taking to enter chinuch, people mocked me. It wasn't a popular decision in my home. It wasn't a popular decision. What do you mean? What are you doing? What? How? Just no one's fool. Just you don't get it. So if you don't get something, your first response is mocking. It takes a broad imagination to be able to see decisions that you don't understand and to credit them. I know a lot of people in America don't get what Gush Etzion is, don't get where the yeshiva is, they mock the yeshiva. I understand. It's just small. It's small and ignorant, not mean-spirited and vindictive. They just don't get it. I wish they get it. It's not their fault. Right? They don't get it. Then they're underexposed. They don't get what we're trying to do. And what does she do? And now listen to these words really carefully. This is, I think, the word that describes Miriam. Such a powerful word. So, Amarlah, so he tells her, source number Dalet, Biti, Hecha Nevuatayach, where is your prophecy? What happens? What are you telling me? What happened to your prophecy? Lefikach. Okay, let's read one. Veoda. Last word on the first line. So look at this really carefully. Veoda. Mechazekes b'nevuasa. She still remains stout. She still remains valiant. Shenemar v'teisatzav achosel merechok ledea ma ye'aselo. The word teisatzav means nitzavim. She stands tall. That's a metaphor. Not that she's standing tall with good posture or denial. She's standing tall because she won't take the mockery. She knows she was right, and even if she was wrong, she was right. Even if Moshe will be devoured, she made the right call. So she doesn't let people's ridicule get to her. And here Chazal says something amazing. She says, look at the source number Dalet, Ein Yitziva Ela Nevua. This term, Yitziva, v'teisatzav, is paraprophetic. Doesn't mean she was a Navi. If she was a Navi, she would have told her father Amram, oh, by the way, I know what's happening in the end. She didn't say that. She didn't know that. If she knew that, then she wanted to see the Dea Mayasela. The Dea Mayasela means sitting at the Nile, I don't know what's going to happen. She's probably going to get swarmed by crocodiles or get drowned by the water. She's not a Navi. We don't see her telling anything. She's known as Miriam HaNavir, but that's later on. She's known of what she brings. Doesn't know where this is landing. But Nevuah is spirit. And sometimes Hashem gives you that spirit as he does to a Navi, and sometimes people generate spirit as she does when she's courageous and valiant and defies the crushing world around her. It's such a powerful physical description of moral courage. Vateisatzav. You stand and you are not broken by a world that will try to break you. Because you believe deeply in a value and you will follow those values without buckling. So this is Moshe. This is the origins of Moshe. This is the origins of redemption. Moshe changes the world. If not for Miriam, who knows when we would have been liberated? Who knows how we would have been liberated? Who knows how history would have been different? Everything that we have is based on this decision of Miriam. Everything. Second part of Miriam, and this I know is a female skill. I wish males had it more. I wish I had it more, but I try. Let me tell you a story, and you'll understand the second trait of Miriam. Did I ever tell you the story about my wife and the vision therapist? No.
Yeah.
Remember the daughter? So that sometimes in life you can't really solve people's suffering, but you can sympathize with them and climb into their world. And Miriam is the first person in Tanakh to demonstrate what sympathy is. At this point, there's nothing more she can add to this story. The baby is being swept downstream, and she should just be turning back and going home. It turns out, by the way, that her waiting by the banks was helpful, because miraculously, and no one could have predicted this, Moshe gets rescued by Batya, and then she connects Moshe and Batya back with Yocheved to nurse Moshe. So this is just totally unexpected. She didn't know that. So why is she waiting by the Nile? What's she doing there? The answer is because her brother's about to die. And you don't just walk your way and turn your back. You share suffering. When people suffer, you don't walk away from it. You share. Just like if you ask me food, can you share some of your schnitzel? I'll give you some of my schnitzel. I have money. Can you share money? Spirit is something you can share. And one of the ways you share spirit is by saying, I'm going to suffer with you. And it's harder because you'd rather not suffer. You'd rather pat yourself and have an easier time and not think about suffering. But the price for sharing spirit is that you have to face pain. Not just face pain, because it's as painful as it may be for you to share someone's pain, it's still someone else's pain. But you're sharing fear. Because when you acknowledge pain, you acknowledge it could happen to you. The real drama of sympathy is not how much pain you feel, because as much as you want to sympathize, you're not going to feel the same searing pain the person feels. It's the denial of vulnerability or the acknowledgement of vulnerability. If you really are engaged, what most people would like to do is to flee from the reality that pain highlights. That life is fragile, and at some point it's going to happen to you, and at some point you're going to suffer, and you don't want to face that. You'd rather flee. You'd rather insulate yourself with a narrative of instability, of a narrative invulnerability. And then there's limitations in how deeply you can feel sympathy. The moment you feel sympathy, you ask yourself, what's the way to feel sympathy? To put yourself in that person's place, right? That's the only way to feel sympathy, is to imagine yourself going through that experience. When you imagine yourself going through that experience, you're admitting that you may have to go through that experience. That's not pleasant. If you don't put yourself into that person's shoes, there's no way you can fully sympathize. It's all going to be artificial. And the closer you can to imagining yourself going through that, the more you can approximate what that person's going through, but it isn't a pleasant experience. But if you have spirit, then Hashem says, okay, I've given you spirit, I've given you comfort, I've given you success, now see if you can share it. And just think about sharing spirit, not just through sympathy. Think about sharing your spirit. People don't get that. It's called generosity of spirit. The generosity of money, you give you money. Generosity, how can it be a generosity of spirit? When people need your tolerance, your patience, your embrace, your approval, that's taking your spirit, and that's why the more spirit you have, the more you can share it. The more you can say, okay, I'll be tolerant. I won't be that angry. I won't be that affected by whatever you're doing. And I'll look past it. I'll absorb it. That's how you become a larger person that shares spirit with people. And that's who Miriam is. V'teisatzav achoso merachok l'de'a mayaselo. And how do I know that this is such a heroic moment? Because Chazal tell us, source number 8, it's in the Gemara in Sota. Miriam himtina l'moshe sha'achas. Talk about appropriate payback. She waits for Moshe for a minute. The Jewish people wait for her on their journey to Israel for 7 days. So Chazal are highlighting the waiting, not the helping. They didn't say, oh, Miriam connected Moshe with Yocheved, therefore we got a lot of man in the Midbar. We got a lot of milk in the Midbar. Because remember, made sure that Moshe had a lot of milk. No. It's not what Chazal are highlighting. They're highlighting that one moment, those 3 minutes, and Miriam waits there by the Nile and just doesn't turn away. She's doing nothing then. She's not saving. She's not rescuing. She's not connecting. She's not headhunting for a nurse. She's just sitting there waiting for Moshe, just watching Moshe and probably crying. So Am Yisrael waits for her. And that's the second trait that I think she gives Moshe Rabbeinu. This is the origins of Moshe. Moshe is born into this world. These are the people who rescue him. These are the people who frame his entry into this world. The third woman, or the second woman in the third trait, is even more interesting. And this I'm having a hard time thinking about as a uniquely female thing, but I'm sure you'll be able to. I'm sure you are. I'll describe it and then you can see about where it plays into your world. Because it is cast, it's not uniquely women, but this element is uniquely women. That's Batya. Now, Batya is an interesting personality. Obviously, her name wasn't Batya, right? It was an Egyptian name, Cleopatra, whatever Egyptian name she had. Ramses, you know, whatever her name was, I don't know. She gets called Batya because of her heroism, the daughter of Hashem. She gives Moshe his name, which we'll talk about in a few moments. That's the name that sticks. Gimena Maimi Shisir. So it's her name. Moshe had seven names, but the name that Torah chooses is her name. Describe Batya. What's the word to describe Batya? So Chazal have a word. And it's an unusual word. And you think it's something toxic to religion. But the answer is, if it were toxic to religion, Hashem wouldn't have put it in your heart. So if he puts it in your heart, it must mean something. It must be something that's a tool that you can use. Where? What is it? So let's turn the page a little bit. Let's read source number, where are we here? Okay, source number three. Okay, see source number three? Source number three provides some of the genealogy. So some of it makes sense. Ishto, Hayehudia, Yalda, Yered, Avi Gader, Vyaschaver, Avi Socho, Vyasikutiel, Avi Zanoach. Remember, a lot of these genealogical lists in Divrei Yomim are not just lists of people, but they're code words and their nicknames, and they highlight people's traits, and especially the end of the pasuk. Ve'ela, these are the children. Bnei Batya Bas Paro. So now you've got my attention. These are the sons of Batya Bas Paro. And according to some versions of Chazal, a lot of these are nicknames for Moshe. So we're not describing different children. We're describing Moshe through his nicknames. He was Gader, Chaver, it was Yekutiel. These are some of the nicknames of Moshe. So he's the son of Batya. Now that we're mentioning Batya, who is Batya's husband? So Batya's husband, eventually, not at this moment she seems to be single, but at some point, she hooks up with an interesting man named Mered. So Mered and Batya got married. What does Mered mean? Rebellion. Who is this man called Mered? Che Guevara? Lenin? Who are the other famous rebels? Korach, Mick Jagger. Who is this rebel? So, Chazal tell us, source number days. Ela b'nei Batya shelakach lo mered, the medrash, line number three. Ze Kalev. Batya marries Kalev. Cool, huh? Cool shidduch. Wonder the shadchanis is. Hey, Kalev, she may not be that Jewish, but it's all right, we'll convert her. Now, why is Kalev called a rebel? What?
That's
spies. He rebels. It would have been so much easier just to be quiet, not join them, but he has a rebelliousness to him that allows him to be defiant and to walk one way when everyone else is shifting the other way. And that's exactly what Batya is. Because she's rebelling against her whole world and even her father, which some teenagers like to do. I've been told. Not my kids, but I've been told. You know, I was a pretty good rebel in my day also, don't worry. And when you're young, you feel rebelliousness. And for adolescents, it comes out one way. It's only adolescent boys it comes out in a way that's fierce and hostile and violent. But try to ignore the adolescent version of it, which can seem very angry and very... So I don't think girls have that same hostility. But what does it mean to rebel? What does it mean to rebel against the narrative that society provides for you? There's a narrative out there. To be a good girl, you have to follow. Well, narratives are formulas for mediocrity. Every stab at excellence takes a certain degree of rebelliousness. And the challenge of life is how to turn rebelliousness into piety. Like I keep telling you, all these traits can be turned. How can you become a better Ovedet Hashem and make a bigger difference? Whatever it is, like think of the decision. Don't tell me, but think to yourself, the decision you'd like to make to be a better Oved Hashem. And can I do it? Like more people say, what would, I don't know. And if you just didn't care about what people would say and you rebelled against it, you'd be all right. Like, I don't know, how many children do you want to have? I'm just throwing questions out. Like, what would it mean if you decide to have a family that, you know, no one would agree with? Like, what does that mean? Whatever, move to Israel, go to Me'ah Shearim and marry a Haredi guy. I'm just, whatever decision you think you're being held back by because society has certain protocols and allowed ceilings, and God forbid you should break through the glass ceiling because we'll accept you and validate you if you just follow the rules and try to find moderate success within the parameters of what's acceptable. Rather than saying, why should I even care? I had a boy come over and speak to me last night in my house at 11 o'clock, and he said, like, he's a little bit dati lomi, he's a little bit yeshivish, and he feels comfortable in both worlds, and he wants to know who to marry. And what I said, get that narishka out of your head. Like, why would you even care about that? Just be the best you can be. Just grow. Stop thinking about those words. Those words are just going to confuse you. You're pre-establishing patterns of thought. You're pre-establishing how you're going to grow by how you live. Just grow. Just be an overhead. Whatever you feel you can grow from, and find a girl who is in the same, doesn't think in boxes or stereotypes. Like, why in the world would you shoot the arrow and then draw the target? You say, I want to be this and then grow into that. You want to grow and independent. These are all silly little denominations that came across in the last 200 years and disappeared in the 50 years. And like, why in the world would you care? This is you. This is your authentic self. This is a chance to really be great. Like, why would you prefabricate any scaffolding that would limit how great you can be? Whether that's ideological scaffolding, which hashkafa, like, who cares? You want to talk to the girl that you're dating about what she believes about the state of Israel, what she believes about women's, whatever those are. Legitimately, you want to make sure that you're on the same page. You only have to make one ideological hashkafic decision in your life. It shouldn't be developmental. It shouldn't be marital. The only time you'll ever have to make that decision, well, for him, okay? For you, it's a little different in Israel. He's living in America. But the only time, now going forward, forget politics and voting, it's mishigas. The only time you're going to have to make a decision along ideological lines is one day you're going to have to get married. You have to decide which community to live in. If you live in Alon Shvut, there's a whole set of advantages and a whole set of disadvantages. If you live in Beit Shemesh, you'll make a decision. But that decision shouldn't identify whom you are. It should just identify which community you live in. I'm not a national religious Jew. I'm a Jew. I made a decision 35 years ago to live in Alon Shvut, well aware of the advantages, well aware of the disadvantages. And if life were different, I'd live in Bnei Brak. I'd hope I'd be the same Jew, well aware of the advantages, disadvantages. Maybe I'll dress differently because one of the rules in that community is you have to dress differently. That's quite frankly why I didn't want to live in that community, because I feel dress is an expression. I don't want to feel like I have to dress up to a certain standard or go away. But that's the only time in life you should ever think about those issues. For the rest of your life, any time you start thinking about those issues, you are prefabricating your growth. You're pre-boxing. So for growth, if it was nice and neat little boxes of ideology, then good luck. But if life is real and authentic and people and growth and identity, and you just want to gain as much as you can, and you're fearless, you don't care, you don't need to be boxed, you don't need to be defined. Ideology is a poor man's substance. You either become a person of substance or become a person of ideology. It's hard to be both. So you just want to take a stamp and stamp yourself and identify, and then everything is done for you, and follow the rules and connect the dots, and I'm a Dati Lomi, I'm modern Orthodox. And so I'm not telling you to live in different communities. Most of you, as I did, I grew up in a modern Orthodox community, so I chose a community that more or less reflected that. Whatever, it's more natural to me, to my emotional. I'm not modern Orthodox. I'm not Dati Lomi. I'm not. Why would you want to be that? Why would you want to be any prefab? Same thing. Why would you want to prefabricate who you're going to become based on what society thinks is acceptable? And at some point, you have to have the willingness, again, not to rebel, to throw glass bottles at people and burn tires and Molotov cocktails. I don't mean that type of rebel. I mean someone that just doesn't have to listen to people's marching orders in society. It's not people. It's not evil. I don't want to all of a sudden cast the walls. These evil tyrants who are dictating our behavior. They're sitting in some dark room with a big computer. It's just social and society and social norms and what's expected and what people smile at, what people... And that's what I see in Batya. I mean, she was defying the whole world. She's basically walking away. If Pyro found out, she's living in a homeless shelter. She goes from palace to pauper and overnight. She defies her father. She defies all community because she sees someone. And again, it's probably a moral value. She sees a baby crying and her heart goes out. But it's the rebelliousness that allows her to stand and resist all this genocidal. So that's another place I'd like to go back to in my DeLorean, visit all the great rebels in history who defied society's convincing whispers about what you should. All the people that saved Jews in the Holocaust, all the people that... It sounds a little bit like the first trait, but it's different. The first trait is the world around you feels dark, and you make decisions in darkness. The last trait is everyone's moving left, and you move right. Don't take left and right, seriously. Everyone's moving right, you're moving left. Everyone's saying, this is what you should do, and you're saying, but that's not what I think. And it's really hard, because the natural expression of rebelliousness, especially in the religious theater, is rejection, not going to be for a lot of people who are rebels. It's hard to combine these traits with, it's, you know, the easiest way for you to be from? Submission, submission, submission. Safety, safety, safety. Submit, 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 which at the core of Avodah Zarah, that's the core. That's the core for everyone. No matter who you are, the core is submission. That's where it starts. Ana avda dekatzur baruch hu. But do you mix submission with assertion? Do you mix submission with confidence? Do you mix submission with creativity? Do you mix submission with self-authorship? Do you mix submission with courage? If you can, then you have a very powerful mix and a very powerful blend of Avodas Hashem. And that's what I'm trying to move you towards. It doesn't. They don't seem to be congruent traits. They don't seem to be consistent. What do you mean? I'm supposed to be pious. I'm supposed to be Hashem. I'm supposed to not defy. I'm supposed to, you're right, don't defy Kadosh Baruch Hu, but defy. There was a Musar school called Nevardak. Each Musar school, and these Musar schools were radical, not the Musar you know. Musar in the 19th century was radical Musar. Radical. It was even, most of the yeshivas didn't want Musar. Yeshivas split. There were fist fights in the yeshivas. What are you doing? What are you trying to scream all day? Bang the table all day? I told you the story about the kid who walks into, it got so bad and so loud that they actually had to kick people out of the Beis Medrash because Musar was trying to get moral ideas into human subconscious and they didn't have Freud to understand how to do it. So they were looking for physical gestures that would allow ideas to become internalized. So it's called in the Musar world, Hispalus. How can you learn Hispalus? So what does it mean to learn Hispalus? So when I try to think about morality, I'll read, I'll think, I'll write. You know what learning Musar with Hispalus is? Banging, screaming, shouting, moving. It's fascinating. So they were looking for a conduit into the subconscious. And it's literally pre-Freud. They didn't have the terminology. So they were looking for it and they didn't have it, if I'm being honest. So they had all these interests. And I'm sure they worked then. Today, they're laughable, obviously. So you'd read be shouting, take one sentence and shout it 1,000 times, 10,000 times, screaming. So they actually had to build an annex to local Bate Medrash because everyone's trying to learn Torah, and these crazy, crazy fanatics are shouting at the top of their lungs. So it's called the Musar Klois. Klois in Yiddish means house, Musar, a little like hut. You go there, you Meshuganis, and you go to the Musar Klois a little bit. So they went to the Musar Klois. So the joke goes that boy leaves the Beis Medrash one night, the regular Beis Medrash, and he says, I've heard about these crazy Musar people. Let me go see what they're up to. So the next day, shows up bright and early, the Musar Klois. And right after davening, everyone takes off their talis and tefillin, and the Alter Rebbe, the star, the Musar house, strides up to the Bima. Everyone's waiting, sitting around, takes his hat, he slams it against the table, and he screams, Ich bin a garnished, which means in Yiddish, I'm a nothing. Ich bin a garnished. Ich bin. The boys are sitting there, watching him with reverence. Ich bin a garnished. Time, and he starts bleeding and paddling. Hours and hours and hours pass. Just an amazing, amazing scene. So this little rookie says, yeah, let me try it. So he goes off to the side, finds his own table. He goes, Ich bin a garnished. Ich bin a garnished. Starts getting a routine. Ich bin a garnished. Ich bin, he's really sincere. Ich bin a garnished. Ich bin a garnished. Time again. Bang, bang, bang. Slowly but surely, like all the fans, so I say, hey, this guy's pretty good. So one by one, all the fans migrate over to the new guy. And by the time the day's over, there's only one person still left watching the old superstar. And everyone's watching the new kid on the town, the new kid on the block. Ich bin a garnish. He's really sincere, really has it. Rhythm and style and blood, everything's really perfect. So 10 o'clock comes at night, time to go home. So the superstar picks up his head, wipes off the sweat, the blood, looks around, no one's watching him. Where's everyone? Oh my goodness, looking over at the side, they're all watching him. He says, a chutzpah. He's here one day. One day, and he thinks he's already more of a garnish than I. This is a chutzpah. Ich bin the garnished. Er ist nicht the garnished. So the person was looking, was always looking for, had a, it's really fascinating. Anyway, so each Musar school chose a trait. So the Navardic Musar school decided that rebelliousness was going to be the trait around which Jewish identity and religious identity was built. Conviction, strong-mindedness, don't cave, public ridicule, don't care. They would actually pursue what was called bizyonis. Bizyonis comes from the word bizayon. They would intentionally seek out mortifying situations just to train themselves not to care. So they'd go into a butcher store, and they'd say, can I have a shirt? And the butcher would say, you idiot. You fool. Don't you know we sell meat here? We don't sell shirts. And then you go to the market and say, I want an elephant. What are you, a lunatic? We don't sell elephants here. We sell lettuce and tomatoes. And that would train them to resist. Okay, it was very radical. But do you have any of that in you? Or are your wallflower is going to wilt the second someone rolls their eyes at you? The second someone disagrees with your decision because it's brave and it's bold and you're really striving to do something. Everyone's trying to mock you into submission. So that to me is also interesting because typically when you say rebelliousness and defiance, it's associated with men, but just because during adolescent years, boys tend to be very rebellious and it's part of males looking for their own identity, trying to escape their father complex, and women have other issues, trust me. I'm above an ass. I know, I get the concept, but at some point when you grow up, how can you be a rebel? Silent rebel. Doesn't have to be loud. You don't have to be angry with your parents. You don't have to burn down the state house or burn down the flag or anything. But just how can you decide to do something and it's going to take some rebelliousness because society is not going to approve of it. Okay, but if it's right, again, don't Society doesn't approve it. Don't do something illegal. Don't do something that's intrusive on someone else. But in your own life, to do what you think is right and to pursue that rightness. Again, where's the balance between rebelliousness and listening to other people, right? So I retire to do what I write. So I'd be a self-arbitrator. Obviously, you have to listen to people. But when you know something's right and you're just backing down from it because it's not approved by the social norms and genteel society and what's expected, and you don't want to cross beyond the boundary or go off the lane or something because this is the lane you're expected. What does a good girl do who goes to Migdalos, fill in the blanks? Well, she starts in Chorev and she comes for a year or two to Migdalos and then goes to the Tzava and works in high tech or something and then goes to Bar Ilan and become, you know, and majors in Mishpatim or something. And then, okay, well, some people say, well, that could be excellent, but do you dare to veer? Do you dare to say, no, maybe something else out there for me? Okay? So here are the three traits that set the scene for all of Moshe's compassion and all of his loyalty and all of his social crusade, everything, all his moral indignance. It's really the women in his life who set the stage. Really think about it. It's a fascinating parsha for women, right? And since I'm here anyway, I mean, I'll just give you my 2 cents because I think these are important. It's important for you to hear these voices so that you'll be able to make the right decisions, okay? Feminism is an extremely, extremely important agenda. And I hate when people say it's a women's issue. It has nothing to do with women. It's a communal issue. And anyone who starts feminism by saying when women come forward, or it's nothing to do with women. As far as I can tell, we're all living together on the same roof. We're all sharing the same resources. It's just a question of creating equal opportunities and equal rights. And I can't imagine any Ben Torah not seeing the concept of feminism, not necessarily the application of feminism, but the concept of feminism, with all of its dangers, obviously with all of its dangers, but to the degree that because of undereducation and discrimination and chauvinism, women suffered, let's say. Forget equal opportunity, they're suffering, so you weren't alleviating suffering. There's just no one was complicit in it. It was just the way the world evolved, lack of education, lack of opportunity. But it created suffering. Now, are there dangers to feminism? Of course there are, a whole boatload of them or whatever, but the desire to improve conditions for people who have less, like, you can't disagree with that. You can say, I don't think we should advance that agenda because there are too many dangers. Okay, that's a cost-benefit analysis. Believe me, it's a cost-benefit analysis. And it's not a cost-benefit analysis that you're the victims of, you're the beneficiaries of it. A person can say, I think feminism is terrible for women, and that would be a coherent comment, but the desire to create a better state of affairs, how could anyone not want to be part of that? And how could any Ben Torah not feel driven, or Bastar feel driven to participate in that? The problem is, and here's the problem, okay? When, and look, you know this better than me, and you're going to have to be the judges of this. When a woman comes, when communities try to find new voices for sincerely religious and devout women, instead of devout men, but new voices for the female members of that community, in order to enhance their avodas Hashem, that's something that we have to take seriously and we have to respect. The answer may not be yes because of all sorts of factors. The answer may be not now because sometimes change is better if it's gradual, whatever, but that's one scenario. And then there's another scenario, and that's why I gave that introduction, where you have the sense that it's not about religion, it's about feminism, and religion is being used to advance the feminist agenda. And that's why I said before, I'm all in for feminism. I'm totally in there. But nothing should ever, religion should never be used for anything other than religion. It is an end unto itself. And it's hard to know when the requests, the movement is really religious and from, and people are looking to be better over the Hashem in a sincere way. The answer could be yes, the answer could be no, but that's legitimate and respectful. And when it's not just feminism, it's other agendas hijacked our in Yerushalayim. It's not just feminism. You have to have a keen politics and the keen eye. And I'll use a very, very harsh word because I want you to hear that word, so that you'll remember it, because it's the most graphic word I could use. And I apologize for using it in this context, because I'm a man, you're a woman, but it's for the sake of your ability to calibrate properly the rest of your life, you have to hear this word. Religion should never be prostituted for anything else. And if it is, it's mamish prostitution. Religion is avodas Hashem. It is its own self-sufficient ends. It cannot be a means. And I can't tell you how to make that decision, but that should be your yardstick. In general, the way is how people ask, is this a community of men and women that are sincerely from, and that frumkeit is expressed across the total suite. Again, in the case of women, but these women who are generally very makbir on Shabbos and very makbir on tefillos and very makbir on all the mitzvahs. And again, now can I feel like I want something different and something more? And of course, okay. Again, I'm not saying we're the answer. The answer could be yes or no, but that's a meaningful, substantive, serious, reverential conversation. And we don't know the answers to those, but the second you sense prostitution, the second you sense that it's not about avodas Hashem, it's just about something large, not large chas v'shalom, but something else, and religion is being drawn in, whether it's feminism or any other agenda, you have to bolt. You cannot exploit or prostitute religion for anything else. And there's just nothing to the Parsha Shemos, but I'm not telling you what decisions to make, but I need you to start. That should be your starting point. What are we dealing with here? We're dealing with serious, sincere avodas Hashem requests. Are we dealing with basically advancing agendas at the cost or with the fuel of religion? And that is unholy. And it's not just unholy when it's feminism that hijacks religion. It's unholy when anything else hijacks religion, any other movement. Because a vote of Hashem has to be a safe spot and a space that it's all about a Kodesh Baruch Hu, nothing else. And if not, the whole system collapses. Okay, so that's your starting point. Good luck deciding who is and who isn't, and good luck deciding what the answers are, even if the people are serious. I don't know the answers to those questions. But this is pre. This is how you approach it and how you discern between the two. Now, you shouldn't be mean to anyone, obviously, but I think a lot of, again, I'm rambling here, but I think a lot of where we get it wrong, when I say we, I mean male rabbis, a lot of where male rabbis and communities get it wrong is body language. They're different, even if the answer is no, there are different ways to say no. It could be with a sense of understanding, this is where we're heading, and we need to do it, but we're not ready for it yet, or it's going to have ramifications, it's going to have repercussions, I understand, not heavy-handed, not dismissive, not, and then sometimes people don't have that emotional intelligence, and it comes across as cynical, or chauvinistic, or what's another word for chauvinism? Bigoted. What?
Patriarchal.
Patronizing, whatever, it just comes across as dismissive and disrespectful. In general, in life, you have to learn how to say no out of respect. And give that person the sense that you understand it and just you disagree because of larger factors rather than dismissing people out of haste. And unfortunately, whatever, this is a rant. But I wasn't here to talk about feminism, I was here to talk about Moshe's mothers. But since we're butting against it and touching it, I just want to make sure that I got that in. You know, for some other point. Do we have time for Ramikon? No, we don't. Okay. We'll get to it, Ramita. We'll get this is important, okay? Shabbat Shalom, everyone. It's a good Shabbos to be a woman. It's a good Shabbos to be a man also. Yes.